Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 23rd, 2012. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This week, entrepreneurship in the developing world, microbes in the immune system, and robots that fly. Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Developing countries account for a bigger chunk of the world economy every year. In an education forum this week, Iqbal Khadir argues that much of this growth has been driven by entrepreneurs and that this can be encouraged through changes in education in the West. He spoke with science editor Brad Weibel about how Western universities can better train entrepreneurs for the challenges of building business anywhere.
In the West, many very good universities have excellent programs on entrepreneurship. And by and large, the students who take advantage of that program are pursuing entrepreneurial careers in the Western countries. And at the same time, there are a lot of programs in these universities that train students for economic planning or policy intervention. And indeed, those are needed or they get employed in their governments, in the multilateral organizations, or in multinational companies that operate in developing countries. But in the middle, there is not that much, very little actually, programs where the programs are dedicated to producing entrepreneurs for developing countries. Of course, this is somewhat of a random phenomenon. There are entrepreneurs emerging no matter what their training is, but there is no dedicated program or hardly any that are producing entrepreneurs for developing countries.
In your story, you talk about a few key components that you suggest should be taught at Western universities to promote entrepreneurship training for the developing world. And one of the key components, you argue, is case studies of entrepreneurship in the developing countries, specifically to focus on how setbacks were overcome, for example. And,
right.
And you also mentioned some individuals and their enterprises in the article. So I was wondering, in light of that recommendation, are there any particular lessons to be learned that you think could be incorporated into these case studies from someone who has demonstrated some success?
Yes. According to research, mentorship has tremendous effect on entrepreneurs being successful. According to Carl Schramm, who ran the Kauffman Foundation, his research, it apparently triples the success rate of entrepreneurial endeavors. But the similar thing is to write cases on actual problems that entrepreneurs ran into and how they overcame them. Either way, either through mentorship or through case writing, what we find is really useful is to expose real-world problems and how someone solved the problem and educate and also inspire the student that indeed it's possible to solve such a problem. We find these various traps that entrepreneurs could run into and actual examples of how they overcame them to be very useful.
One key element of this proposal would be to go to the universities in the West and say, well, here's what's in it for you. How might they benefit? And one thing that you point out, and I'd like you to elaborate on, is what are some of the gains that Western researchers and universities could get from these sort of collaborations?
Sure. The Western universities have done a great deal for developing countries, but them becoming more economically important, I think, also brings whole new set of problem areas that universities could work on. So first of all, the universities would simply be better connected to the actual problems that the entrepreneurs are trying to solve. The second is that there are innovations in developing countries that are taking place, sometimes by individuals at the ground level, but sometimes even by multinational corporations like General Electric has done, where they produced a low-cost electrocardiogram originally produced for Indian market. But just like the corporations under profit pressure have done certain things to address the needs of developing countries, universities can also learn from that. And they already do it. But if they get greater engagement through actual problem solving that entrepreneurs face, then I think the universities could stand to gain a lot more about what kind of problems that needs to be solved year to year. I'm not quite saying that the universities do not solve these problems, but I think the engagement can be greater, and that greater engagement can be produced through being involved with the entrepreneurs.
In your article, you mention cell phone use or phone service as one technology that is transforming people's lives and creating markets in the developing world. And I wonder if among the success stories that you cite there, if there's any particular case that you think might be interesting to our readers in terms of, again, illustrating what is a unique setback that might have been encountered in the developing world that the programs you describe could help address.
Sure. I think the most prominent example is Mo Ibrahim, who brought cell phone technology in 14 different African countries. He was born and raised in Sudan, but subsequently he got a great deal of education in England. I think all his 3 degrees. And he went back, so he not only knew his country, he also had the technical knowledge. So he knew his country, that's what I call the home field advantage, and the daring, and perhaps even sometimes you need the attachment to a cause or to a region that you want to serve. He had all those things that he brought together to create these cell phone services. And indeed, millions of people have embraced this technology that's very high tech, but at the same time, they are providing that economic value that I talked about. And as a result, they have embraced it. And remember, this is the conditions where there is not enough checks and balances in the governance of the countries, or there isn't enough even supply of electricity. So these kind of problems he has overcome one after another. That's the kind of example other such students in Western universities can learn from. See, the students that want to be entrepreneurs don't necessarily have to come to the West, but the West does offer a bunch of things, like, for example, the cell phone technology, or even the convening power of other Western entrepreneurs, or even angel funding. Mo Ibrahim was very much backed by venture capital. You see, the entrepreneurs really assembles many forces. And so some of that assemblage can happen in the Western countries. And at the same time, he can take that to a country that needs it, that he has an advantage that others do not have. Bringing all those connections together is the role of the entrepreneur. And the Western universities, on top of their academic prowess or research prowess, they have that convening power to help these entrepreneurs bring about. And it's actually naturally happening. But perhaps greater attention would give rise to greater good, not only for those countries, but also for these universities.
In the paper, you list some impressive success stories and note that these happened in the current structure of education where you have the traditional development training and entrepreneurship training. So if these people have been able to be successful under the current structure, what is the problem that you think needs to be addressed with these new programs that you propose and describe?
See, there are always exceptional cases. So, for instance, again, if we go back to Mo Ibrahim, he studied a great deal in England, and then he worked in British Telecom. He was very well experienced in mobile technology. So his success is partly attributable to such a extraordinary background he had. But if we only depend on these extreme cases, then obviously we cannot have as much success as the world needs. So I think if we have programs and encourage or allow or equip people with a lot lesser skills, perhaps at a younger age or less experience, then there would be higher yield of these sort of entrepreneurial successes. And I think the world could use that.
Great. Iqbal, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brad.
Iqbal Qadir writes about training entrepreneurs for the developing world in an education forum this week. In an editorial this week, Junie Miner, president of California's Foothill College, discusses the importance of community colleges in educating the United States workforce.
I think one of the main differences is the fact that community colleges have a primary mission in teaching. And when you contrast that to the research and publication functions that characterize most four-year colleges and universities, that does set us apart.
You can listen to more of the interview and read the editorial in our March 23rd issue at www.sciencemag.org.
In an era of ubiquitous hand sanitizer and hypoallergenic pets, an open debate in the field of immunology is the hygiene hypothesis, the notion that early exposure to microbes and allergens challenges an organism's immune system, thereby bolstering its development and helping to prevent immune overreactions like asthma later in life. Almost by accident, a team of researchers stumbled upon experimental evidence for this hypothesis while studying the role of CD1D protein pathways in regulating the immune response to microbes. Senior author Richard Blumberg spoke with me about the research and began with an explanation of the main characters of this story, a family of immune cells called invariant natural killer T cells.
Invariant NKT cells are T cells that express a novel group of markers, including NK markers, and they respond to either cytokines derived from innate immune cells, such as interleukin-12, or lipid antigens, as opposed to classically restricted T cells. And now these lipids may be either endogenous lipids, that is derived from self, or they can be exogenous lipid antigens, and therefore of microbial origin. Because of this, invariant NKT cells express an activated phenotype under basal conditions, and they respond very quickly and vigorously to their activating stimuli, both antigenic and cytokine-derived, and consequently affect many downstream immune pathways.
And by antigenic stimuli, you mean allergens, things like that?
Yes. In fact, there's data from Mitch Cronenberg's group that dust mite allergen contains some yet-to-be-defined CD1D restricted NKT cell activating antigens. And because of this, NKT cells play a very important role in regulating commensalism, responding to infectious agents, eliminating tumors, and either preventing or promoting a variety of immune diseases such as asthma or inflammatory bowel disease.
So we like T cells. They're part of the immune response that fends off antigens, but we don't want them to build up too much.
We don't want them to build up too much. We want them, like every other aspect in immunobiology, we want them to be controlled.
Okay, so you wanted to know how the age of exposure to microbes influences the immune response and the behavior of T cells. So how did you go about setting up an experiment to test that?
Well, we used the good old-fashioned axenic system, axenic meaning no microbes, and grew mice under these axenic or notobiotic conditions. And then we examined the role that reintroduction of commensal microbes played in regulating the NKT cells. And we specifically looked at the age dependency of those effects and the downstream effects of the microbes, in particular the numbers of NKT cells in the tissues, their phenotype, the expression of CD1D in the tissues and chemokines that regulate NKT cells, and then further examined these axenic mice or mice that had been recolonized with microbes to model systems that reflect lung inflammation, such as in asthma, or colitic inflammation, such as in inflammatory bowel disease.
Huh. So one of the groups of mice that you're working with, these axenic mice, are germ-free. They have absolutely no germs or microbes anywhere in their bodies. How exactly does one breed and raise germ-free mice?
First of all, you have to basically get embryos under sterile conditions from a pregnant mother, then reintroduce them and put them into a foster mother that's germ-free. These models that we have access to have been maintained germ-free for generations. It's so difficult to re-derive them and then to breed them under these axenic conditions that there are very few strains that are actually germ-free. It's a very time-intensive and expensive process because the bubbles that they're actually bred in all have to be sterilized. The food has to be sterilized. So it's obviously this kind of veterinary agriculture is only done in very few settings. And that was the beauty of these experiments, is that it brought together my laboratory, which has a lot of experience in NKT cell biology and mucosal immunology, and Dennis Casper's lab, who is a world-renowned microbial biologist and has a germ-free facility himself in his own laboratory, which is very unusual. And so by teaming together our two groups with his expertise in microbiology and germ-free science and my expertise in mucosal immunology and NKT cell biology, we were able to make this very interesting discovery.
So you had these two groups of mice, the first that were germ-free, raised in totally sterile conditions, and the second, the so-called specific pathogen-free mice, which had their own microbial systems. And you basically induced in these mice either inflammatory bowel disease or asthma. So what were your results here? How did the immune responses differ in these two groups?
Well, the results were really quite startling. In the first experiments, we observed quite unexpectedly that the numbers of invariant NKT cells based upon their ability to bind CD1d tetramers was dramatically enriched in the colon and the lung specifically relative to other tissues. And consonant with that increase in numbers of invariant NKT cells, when we examined the sensitivity of the germ-free mice to the development of colitis or their sensitivity to the development of asthma, that quite unexpectedly the germ-free mice had much, much greater evidence of colitis and much, much greater evidence of asthma in comparison to the specific pathogen-free mice.
So the germ-free mice, those that were not exposed to any microbes at all when they were young, really had quite a bad reaction to colitis, inflammatory bowel disease, or asthma.
Yeah, so those specific experiments came a little bit later, but yes, when mice were born germ-free, as opposed to mice that were born in the presence of normal quantities of bacteria, that is, in the specific pathogen-free state, and then were examined later in life, yes, those germ-free mice exhibited profoundly increased inflammation of the lungs and the colon, which is very surprising given the fact that all T-cell models to date, that is, models dependent upon adaptive immunity, show no evidence, at least, of colitic inflammation or inflammation of the colon in the absence of bacteria.
Now, what exactly is happening on the molecular level to give rise to these different responses?
Well, we investigated that, and we found that it did not at least appear to be due to abnormalities in CD1d expression, that the amounts of CD1d expression in the colon and the lung were the same in the germ-free and the specific pathogen-free mice. But what we discovered was, in fact, that it would seem to be associated with increase in a chemokine ligand, CXCL16, that was dramatically increased in the serum and in the tissues associated with the lung and the colon in the germ-free mice.
So this is all a very important concept in human immunology. You know, there are lots of questions about what sorts of environments you can expose young children to. So is it too early to be taking any of these studies on mice and applying them to humans?
Well, it's a very good question. What we discovered was that we could only reverse this phenomenon if we colonized the mice in early life, but not in later life, mm-hmm. as you alluded to. And so that there had to be a critical microbial signal that was provided in the first 2 weeks of life, as we can deduce, in the germ-free context that allowed the germ-free mice to become normalized to the specific pathogen-free-like state. And if that signal was not provided in those first 2 weeks of life and was attempted to be provided in later life, we could not reverse the later life sensitivity to inflammation of the lung and the intestine. So trying to take that information back to human, it will be very important. We think that we can because of the great similarities between the CD1 pathways in mouse and human. Mm-hmm. But also there's an enormous amount of epidemiologic data now that is consistent with these observations, and that the lack of proper early life exposure to microbes, either because of introduction to microbes that are associated with westernized, industrialized circumstances or the exposure to antibiotics during early life, cannot allow for proper immunologic education that provides protection to later life stimuli to environmental antigens. And so we feel that with these models, we can perhaps utilize the mouse system either with specific reintroduction of microbes, either derived from a mouse or from even a human, that is a humanized mouse, to begin to try to uncover the early life requirements for the maintenance of later life, if you wish, tolerance, at least associated with the NKT cell pathway. So I'm very optimistic, given the similarities between these pathways and the observations that we've made, and that we have at least a tractable pathway that we can focus on, that we might be able to define the specific microbes and their antigens.
Well, this is all very exciting. Richard Blumberg, thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Richard Blumberg and colleagues report on exposure to microbes in the immune response in a paper published online this week by Science. You can read the article at www.scienceexpress.org.
Want more science in your life? Check us out on Facebook and Twitter at Science Magazine, where you can read highlights, join discussions, or take your best shot at our weekly quiz.
Despite the clear success of fixed-wing airplanes, flapping-wing flying machines have been an object of fascination since Leonardo da Vinci and well past the Wright brothers' time. I spoke with Dana McKenzie about his News Focus article on the latest innovations in flying, flapping-winged robots and some of the uses of these novel machines.
To me, the story is that finally, after 2,000 years, we're close to building machines that can actually fly like a bird and also land like a bird, which turns out to be, in some ways, even harder than flying.
Well, so we're talking about ornithopters here.
That's right.
Can you describe maybe one of the more modern ornithopters that we're seeing these days?
Sure. Well, one of the ornithopters I wrote about in my article is called the Smart Bird. It's made by a company in Germany called Festo. And last year, they publicly demonstrated for the first time a flapping robot, which is modeled after a seagull. It's got an exterior skin that has kind of been made to look like a seagull.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, inside it's completely different. It's got all these ultralight materials, carbon fiber body and so forth. And one of the impressive things about it, it's got these articulated wings that bend like real seagull's wings. But one of the key ideas that makes it work is something called active torsion, where the wings actually twist as they go up and come down. And this is something you can see real birds do as well, but it hasn't traditionally been considered to be that important to flapping wing flight. But in fact, the Festo team was very careful to synchronize this twisting with the flapping in such a way that they get the maximum aeronautical efficiency. And that is really one of the reasons that this bird flies so beautifully.
Wow. Well, so how do these flapping wings stack up in terms of efficiency against, you know, things that are more mechanical, like a propeller?
Well, you know, actually one of the reasons that we haven't been able to fly with flapping wings for so long, and instead we fly in airplanes with fixed wings, is that, in fact, fixed wings work better for a lot of purposes. So in fixed-wing airplanes, we generate thrust and lift in two different places. We generate thrust with the propeller, and we generate lift with the fixed wing, whereas a bird generates them both in the same place. And that is a lot trickier to do. What we find is that with a propeller, it's more efficient at generating thrust than a bird's wing. If you think about it, when we build airplanes, we basically try to set up the simplest possible situation with steady flow over the wing,
mm-hmm.
where there's no sort of vortices and no oscillations. In fact, if an airplane wing vibrates, that's very bad. In the early days of air flight, things like that happened. You know, wings would vibrate, airplanes would stall, and people would die. By this sort of brutal experience, aeronautical engineers became very conservative in their designs. And so our planes are basically designed to work only with nice, smooth flow of the air around the airplane wing. But that's not the way a bird works. You know, a bird flapping its wing creates unsteady airflow, both when it's in flight, because the airflow is oscillating all the time, and especially when it's landing. When the bird lands, it changes its angle of attack. It basically inclines its wings by like 45 degrees to 60 degrees compared to the line of flight. And this creates a condition called dynamic stall.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that airplanes do their best to avoid. You don't want to stall an airplane. It means it'll crash. But birds do it every time they land, and they do it successfully.
Is this kind of stalling on purpose for a landing something that the new machines can do?
Well, it's something that they're working on. One of the groups I wrote about in my article is at MIT, and they are actually working on robotic airplane that can perch just like a bird. They've done it for a glider. They've shown that they can land on a wire 19 times out of 20.
So how does a glider land on a wire?
Well, so a bird, a real bird, has a brain.
Yes.
And that's hugely important. You think about the wings as being the most important flying organ for a bird, but no, it's the brain that flies. And right now, the brain is a separate computer. They have a high-speed camera photographing the plane as it's coming in for the landing, and they have a computer working out what to do with the control surfaces so that it won't crash and will actually land on the perch.
So the perch is a stick?
They use a wire, and there's sort of some fine print here, which is that they don't actually have claws yet to grasp onto the wire. So right now, what they define as a successful perch is if they can get the wire to hit a certain target on the bird, on the robotic bird.
So it's like a belly flop onto a
wire.
Yeah,
that's right. So the wire hits the target, they're satisfied, and then the bird, you know, crashes because it doesn't actually have claws to grip the wire. But, you know, that would be the next step.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things you bring up a couple times in your story is some military applications for this new technology or this advancing technology. But who are some of the other interested parties that might take advantage of this?
As it turns out, one interested party is Disney. First of all, it's just beautiful watching these robotic birds flying. And Disney would love to have Tinkerbell come and fly in and land, you know, on a lamppost or something like that. So they actually, believe it or not, and I did not mention this in my article, Disney actually hired the student who designed this perching glider.
Wow.
And he won a Boeing Engineering Student of the Year award, and Boeing wanted really badly to hire him, but he went to work for Disney. So that's kind of cool, I think.
I can kind of imagine a flying, I guess it would be human plus bird type machine here. So that brings up for me the idea of size constraints. You talk a little bit about these nano hummingbirds. Is there an upper and lower bound to what we can build that will fly like a bird?
Yeah, that's a great question. My article is mostly about robotic flight. And so you might say, well, that's still not really flying like a bird. I mean, I want to flap my arms. So there are definitely scale issues. So there's something called the square cube law. Basically, as a bird or a plane or whatever gets larger, its surface area doesn't get big as quickly as its weight. If you double your size, you have four times the area under your wings, but you have eight times the weight. And so you quickly get to sort of diminishing returns. So as it turns out, it's really much easier to fly with a miniature flyer. And one of the other things that I wrote about in the article is this miniature flying artificial hummingbird that was developed by a company called AeroVironment. So with miniature flyers, the aerodynamics are easier, but of course the miniaturizations is the hard part. But then going to the other extreme, if you want to talk about getting on board an ornithopter and either flapping your arms or getting a motor to do it for you, then the challenge is the cube square law. And, you know, there have been a few attempts to fly with human-powered or with engine-powered ornithopters with a human on board. And they've been what I would say as barely successful.
So it sounds like a lot of this stuff is on its way, but not quite there yet.
You know, the funny thing is that, you know, we think of it as very primitive, but actually, of course, it's very difficult. It's required the development of ultralight materials. It requires really sophisticated electronics and control surfaces. Another thing is that the money is there and the applications are there, that the military has gotten quite interested. Mm-hmm. You know, you've heard a lot about drones in the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts, and they've been amazingly successful. Well, the military would like to have drones that, A, could not be distinguished from birds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you make a drone that looks like a bird, like a seagull or like a hummingbird or one of these things, then it won't be detected. Also, they'd really love a drone that could perch, because if you want to gather intelligence, You know, you want to fly your bird in and have surveillance on insurgents' headquarters. Mm-hmm. You don't want the hummingbird to be hovering there for hours. It won't be able to do it.
Plus, you know, it's a little conspicuous.
That's right. And, you know, so you'd like to have the hummingbird go in there and sit somewhere, you know, perch somewhere.
Dana McKenzie, it's been really great talking to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Dana McKenzie writes about flapping wing aircraft in a News Focus in this week's Science.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. First up, news about a controversial treatment for depression.
Right, Carrie. This kind of might sound like science fiction, but since the 1930s, doctors have actually been jolting people with electricity. They actually have been hooking up electrodes to people's heads and zapping them to cure depression. The amazing thing is it actually works, but it has a lot of side effects. It can cause memory loss and confusion, and can even lead to difficulty forming new memories. So this new study is all about trying to figure out, why does this shocking people's brains, why does it actually even help depression in the first place? And if we learn more about it, can it lead to better ways to apply this therapy without some of the nasty side effects?
And because it has these side effects, it's not used very often, right?
Right now, today, it's really only used for really severely ill patients, including those at risk for suicide, mm-hmm. where you wouldn't care as much about the side effects because the disease is a lot more serious than the side effects. What researchers did in this study was they actually looked at a bunch of patients and they scanned them with fMRI, which is a technique which measures blood flow in their brain. And one of the going hypotheses about what causes depression is the idea that the brain is actually overactive, that all these regions of the brain are communicating way too much with themselves. So the brain actually becomes preoccupied essentially with itself. It closes itself closes itself off to information from the outside world, which seems to lead to depression. And what the researchers found is that actually seems to be what's happening in these patients' brains. What the researchers did was they looked at the entire brain of these volunteers, and they looked for changes in blood oxygenization in about 27,000 points, known as voxels. And these voxels are essentially the 3D imaging equivalent of pixels on a computer screen. Voxels were considered highly connected if their changes in blood oxygenization were strongly correlated. That is, if one went up and the other went up to a similar degree. And indeed, that's what the researchers found. They found that there was a lot of connectivity between these voxels in depressed patients, which seems to support this hypothesis that people with depression tend to have a lot of this sort of crosstalk going on inside of their brains.
So what are the implications of this on electroconvulsive therapy?
Well, what the researchers also saw with electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT as they call it, is that when they shocked these patients' brain, they saw decreases in this connectivity between these voxels, and they saw less of this sort of hyperactive crosstalk going on in the brain. So their conclusion is that this is how ECT is working. It's stopping the brain from sort of talking to itself so much. And the open question really remains is, you know, using these data, can they find a way to administer ECT without causing such harmful side effects? And that's a point for future study.
So scientists have been using this method for 80 years without actually knowing the parts of brain that it targets?
Right. They just sort of know that it works, but they really didn't know how it worked. And now they've got a pretty good idea.
Wow. And moving on to our next story, we've got some marine acrobatics.
Right. This story, Carrie, is about two species of minuscule crustaceans called copepods, which seem to perform some pretty bizarre acrobatics at the surface of the ocean. They leap out of the water and somersault, sometimes at rates of 7,500 revolutions per minute to escape predators. It's sort of like a bit of a flea circus on the top of the ocean. This new discovery is actually thanks to a researcher who sort of made it by accident. He works at the University of Texas in Austin, and his daily routine is actually to walk along the university's marina, which sits on the Gulf of Mexico. And one day he's walking along and he noticed this unusual pattern in the water. He said it looked like there were raindrops hitting the surface. So sort of interested in what was going on, he ran back to his lab, grabbed a beaker, and scooped up some of the marina water.
Fast thinker.
Exactly. And when he got back to the lab, he discovered these copepods that were living in the water. And you can see a picture of them on the site. They kind of look like tiny lobsters, although they're the size of, actually they're smaller than most ants, so they're really small, but kind of interesting looking. And when he threw some plankton eating fish into the water with these guys, he saw them jumping to safety. Then he grabbed some high speed video cameras and actually taped what was going on. And what he saw was that these copepods, when they were threatened by a predator, they were essentially flying out of the water. They're hitting speeds of about 0.66 meters per second and landing up to 17 centimeters away. And you can actually see a video. It's a bit of a grainy video, but you can see a video of this actually happening on the site.
So this is actually a pretty effective technique for escaping predators.
Exactly. The researchers saw that when the organisms conducted themselves this way, only about one of the 89 jumping crustaceans that this researcher and some of his colleagues saw wound up getting eaten on camera. So it's a very dramatic strategy and also a very effective one as well.
So you said that they can sprint themselves really, really quickly. They can go far. They spin a ridiculous number of times per minute. How can such tiny creatures launch themselves with so much force?
What the researchers saw with their high-speed videos is that these creatures are actually launching themselves with just a single swimming stroke, which is actually kind of amazing. And part of the trick of how they're able to go so far is they actually expend an enormous amount of energy, about 88% of the initial energy required just escaping from the water. Think of yourself in a swimming pool and how hard it is to move around. But then if you get out, all of a sudden it seems a lot easier. That's essentially what's happening with these guys. All this energy that they expend getting to the surface of the water, it sort of explodes when they get out of the water and they're able to just sort of jump and somersault in these sort of incredible ways.
Well, that's pretty incredible.
It is.
And in our third story today, we're talking about some of the earliest brown-eyed girls.
Right. This study, Carrie, concerns Neanderthals, which died out about 30,000 or more years ago. And if you've ever gone to a museum that had a Neanderthal exhibit, you probably saw these relatives of ours sporting pretty striking blue or green eyes. They look like they have pale skin and gingery hair. And this is sort of the typical artist's conception. But a new study suggests that not all Neanderthals look this way. In fact, a couple of female Neanderthals found in Croatia seem to have actually been brown-eyed with brunette tresses and tawny skin to match.
So why did scientists initially think that they may have had lighter colored eyes?
Well, Carrie, there's been this long-held hypothesis that Neanderthals, who lived mostly in the northern latitudes where it was pretty cold, must have had light skin to get enough vitamin D. And that could have gone along with eye color and some of these other features that people had sort of assumed. And that may have sort of lent itself to some of these artist conceptions you see in various museums around the world.
So what new information makes scientists think that, in fact, brown was the common eye color?
Well, what the researchers did in this study was they actually looked at a lot of DNA from three female Neanderthals that were found in Croatia. And their DNA was actually the basis of the first effort to compile a complete Neanderthal genetic sequence, which was published just a couple of years ago. And what the team found was they found multiple genes, which we know in humans seem to control various visual traits like eye color and skin color and things like that. And it turns out there's not just one gene for, say, green eyes and one gene for brown hair. There's actually a lot of genes that, when you add them all up, confer various colors. And what they found, for example, was one of the females had seven genes for brown eyes, one for not brown eyes, three for blue eyes, and four for not blue eyes. And what the researchers say is when you sort of add all these up, this gives a six-gene balance in favor of brown and a negative balance in favor of blue, which to them indicates that this particular individual's eyes were probably browned. And what they found was that when they applied this methodology to all three Neanderthals, all three seem to have had a dark complexion and brown eyes, although one was red-haired.
So do scientists think that their previous impressions were wrong or that just that there might be more diversity than we expected from Neanderthals?
Well, experts are saying we shouldn't necessarily give all those museum mannequins a makeover just yet. They're saying that this additive technique really has a lot of problems because you can't just assume that every gene you look at has the same effect on hair color, eye color, whatever. Some genes are known in humans to have much more powerful effects than others. So just sort of simply adding and subtracting, they say, doesn't really give a convincing picture of what these look like. Although the experts are conceding that, you know, it's probably true that all Neanderthals didn't look exactly the same. And the important thing about this study is it does suggest that there was probably a lot of diversity in these populations, just as there is in our own population.
Right. And so what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about how scientists are measuring the energy spent while people do judo, which is one of the martial arts. Mm-hmm. Also a story about whether there are dangerous levels of mercury in coastal fog water. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how biotech patents are faring in the Supreme Court of the United States. Also a story about the National Children's Study, which is this huge effort that's been proposed by the National Institutes of Health to track 100,000 U.S. children from birth to 21 years old. And what's status of that study. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about whether animals are capable of human thoughts. And next week's Science Live is about personalized medicine. Will our new era of personalized genomics lead to better treatments in the clinic? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and Science Policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the March 23rd, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.